Hello and welcome to the Be Your Own Healer Telesummit. I'm Jonathan Fitzgordon, your host and founder of Core Walking. And I'm here today speaking with Dr. Amay Shunney. Amay Gold Shunney is a licensed naturopathic doctor graduating from the National College of Naturopathic Medicine in Portland, Oregon in 2001. A dynamic educator, radio personality, and writer, Amay is on a mission to empower people to take charge of their health with integrative medicine. Whether speaking to health professionals or lay people, her engaging style, emphasis on patient-centered care, and passionate belief in the health benefits of joyful eating make her an audience favorite. She has lectured extensively to medical students and physicians, and she participates in teaching venues throughout the natural healing community. Welcome, Amay. I'm really pleased to talk to you today.
Thanks for having me. It's really great to get to talk with you.
What does the phrase, be your own healer, mean to you, and why is it important for people to help themselves?
Well, I think that it's probably the most important thing that we can do for ourselves in the healing profession. I know that for me, when you're giving to, you know, in my case, it's to my patients all the time, I really have to kind of keep filling up my own well so that I can continue to give in the deep, intensive way that I do. And so professionally, I think that all of us who, you know, are being available for other people in their pain, whether it's physical, emotional, or whatever it is, you know, we in order to be available, we have to really be taking care of ourselves. So it's something that I try to practice on a regular basis, and of course I find the longer I'm in practice, the older I get, the more I really have to take care of myself. And in my personal life, as my life gets richer and more complicated as I get older, as my son has come into my life and gets older, you know, I have to really practice what I preach and continue to do the things that take care of myself so I can be available for others. When I talk to my patients all the time, and I'm, you know, I'm talking to them about sometimes very serious chronic healthcare conditions, issues that are very debilitating to them, and we're talking about medications, or maybe we're talking about supplements or herbs, diet, lifestyle changes, and at some point, the conversation always comes back to what are you doing to take care of yourself? And I think that's something a lot of people don't get from their doctor, and it's something that I very purposefully try to bring into the discussion with my patients and try to really drive home to them as being just as crucial to their healing as any medicine I might prescribe.
And how would you say your past, or your personal history, has informed the way you're working with people now?
Well, I the way that I discovered naturopathic medicine, I think that kind of informs my practice, and that is when I went to undergraduate school at Vanderbilt University, and I had a degree in psychology, and when I got out of school, I moved to Portland, Oregon, and I started looking for work, and I took a job working with adjudicated youth at a shelter. So I was working with young boys that had kind of gotten in trouble with the judicial system, basically, and were in foster care, or, you know, they were trying to figure out what to do with them before sending them to jail. They were kind of, this was the halfway point. And then from there, I ended up working in an inpatient psych treatment facility for teenage girls, and I was there for 3.5 years. It was an incredibly challenging, moving, and formative time for me as a young woman, I think, and also really guided my choice of career, because what I saw were these young girls who came from the most terrible, damaged, violent, often, circumstances, and what our system had in place to help them was kind of terrible. I mean, there was certainly plenty of medication to go around, and really these girls were so medicated. In retrospect, I really feel like it was just to try to keep them from acting out, really just sedating them largely. They had some therapy, and beyond that, and the food was terrible. Their ability to access physical activity was very limited, and there was just not very much offered to help these really often beautiful, intelligent young women kind of put the pieces of their lives back together. And so I walked out of that job rather disillusioned with the medical system and the mental health system in general, and I set out to try. I thought maybe I could find a holistic counseling program, something that would help me deal with people like that in a more holistic fashion, and that led me towards looking at alternative medicine systems. And I found, maybe you've seen it, that big fat gray hardback book, gray and in red letters, it says alternative medicine, and Deepak Chopra wrote the foreword. It's old by now. It's got to be 15, 18 years old in its first edition, and each chapter is a different modality. And what I found in there was a chapter on naturopathic medicine, and I was like, well, gosh, this is it. I mean, this integrates biological medicine, Western medical science, with this full realm of modalities to use, not just prescription medication. And there were, at that time, 4 accredited schools in the country where you could get that training, and one of them happened to be in Portland, Oregon, where I was living. And so that's what I did, and that's where I went to school. So as a naturopathic doctor, because the education is so vast, you know, you could really specialize in any aspect of medicine, women's health, which is kind of what I do, you know, pediatrics, oncology, or you could specialize in homeopathy or physical medicine. It's so diverse. You know, we all practice a little differently. And for me, I think that background of mine, coming from a psychology background, also coming from a theater background as well, which I feel has always kind of informed and acted on the way that I interact with patients, the way that I listen, the way that I connect with people. And that has always been a really crucial way in which I practice that I don't think all doctors practice, in that I'm always going towards the emotional aspect when I can. I'm always encouraging that deeper looking and that really holistic perspective to try to guide them towards wellness, particularly when it comes to depression and anxiety and mood challenges, which so many people deal with, and just kind of reconciling the different parts of our lives together. And we all struggle for this wholeness. You know, I see that so much in my practice, and I think it takes a certain amount of listening and attention to really hold people's hands while they go there.
You have, you know, most of the, I'm going to ask you this anyway, but most of the people that I've been talking to all have a particular modality. They're either, you know, an acupuncturist or a yoga teacher. And as a naturopath, do you just cover the gamut of offering advice to people? You know, it's nutrition and it's exercise and medicine as well. You cover everything, yes?
Yeah, it's a pretty integrated practice. You know, in some ways, when you come to see me, there's an aspect of it that's a lot like going to your regular doctor, and we sit down with you. I take a history. I do a physical exam where it's necessary. I run lab tests, interpret lab tests. I do prescribe some medicines. I use supplements and herbs, and I do a lot of dietary and lifestyle counseling. I do a lot of hormone balancing. I never would have guessed that that's where my practice would have gone, but nonetheless, that's where it has. And so that has made my practice a bit more medical than I kind of ever imagined it would be. And I do a lot of primary care type things. I help people with blood pressure and cholesterol and blood sugar and allergies and digestion, all that stuff too. But from a modality perspective, it really... You know, I feel fortunate because my exposure to different modalities throughout my life, even outside of naturopathic medicine, you know, my father and his wife are yoga teachers and have been for 30 years. My mother has been a psychotherapist for 30 years. I feel like there's a lot of influences that really do allow me to offer my patients a lot of different things. And even in, obviously, you can't be an expert in all those modalities. But for me, I feel like part of my expertise is also just pulling all those pieces together to get people started and prioritized, and then, you know, when necessary, get them to people who are experts in those areas. You know, I kind of think of myself often as a gatekeeper in that regard, kind of getting people in the direction they need to go.
And I'm curious, like, in terms of the Western medicine, I thought that was really interesting. So you... When you say that your practice, like, has a hormonal piece to it, So you're prescribing hormones, if I had to guess, and if that's true, is that a difficult thing for you? In other words, you came in it as a, you know, I would imagine thinking all naturally and then had to move in that direction?
Sure. You know, hormone balancing is very much a naturopathic and an integrative medicine concept. I mean, we, in conventional gynecology, you know, we give hormones for very specific things. We give it for birth control. You know, we give it in a certain way in menopause. We give it for infertility, for things like that. But this concept of functional hormonal balancing is something that kind of belongs to integrative medicine and naturopathic medicine. So I was taught, that was definitely a part of my education. And actually, you know, a lot of people, the misconception about naturopathic medicine is that we're not, you know, we don't prescribe and we're not taught about drugs. And in fact, our pharmacology training is the same as medical pharmacology training. It's modeled to be the same because as integrative practitioners, you have to be able to understand the drugs and how they're used because you have to know how to give natural things with them. And also the idea is that as a naturopath or as an integrative practitioner, you're really able to walk the line of understanding when drugs and medicines are appropriate. And because they are sometimes, and you know, without a doubt, they are overprescribed and overused, even used with abandon in many cases in conventional medicine. But you know, there are reasons to use medicines, and so I think the sometimes grandiose idea behind integrative medicine is that, well, we know when people really need medicine, and mm-hmm. we can walk that line. So. In that sense, I didn't walk into my profession being against medicine in that way at all.
Right.
But I didn't think that I was going to – I didn't really understand what it was going to mean. And the milieu has changed so much in the last 15 years, you know, what it was going to mean to be an integrative practitioner and that I would sometimes be writing prescriptions for blood pressure medications or for – parasitic and fungal infections or, you know, for vaginal infections when I'm working with gynecology and for hormones often. So I have, you know, over the years gotten more used to that role. I do take it very seriously and I try to hold on, you know, to the way in which I was trained, which is that when other more gentle, less invasive things have been used first and that the decision is always made really looking at the whole picture and weighing the risks and the benefits with my patients as opposed to just handing them a prescription. You know, and when it comes to hormones in particular, you know, it's a really controversial area that the research is always, well, the data is always changing because new research is always coming out. There are many varying ideas about what's the safest way to do it. And, you know, like for me, I only prescribe bioidentical hormones because I believe that when we give hormones that are the exact same chemical structure as what the body makes, we're going to be giving a much more benign and usable substance that's going to have fewer toxic effects. You know, and so, you know, it's a job to stay, you know, to stay up on that and to, you know, consistently feel like I'm giving my patients safe and useful advice. But it's been interesting. This path as a naturopathic doctor, it's like having a baby in the sense that no matter how much someone prepares you for it, you kind of can't possibly understand it until you do it. And I never really conceived of what an uphill struggle it would be to be looking for validity in the health profession as a naturopathic doctor. And I never really understood what an incredible job it would be to try and really practice integrative medicine in a safe and effective way, how much knowledge you have to really be taking into account all the time. It's quite a job.
Yeah, and it's the best of both worlds, I think, for the patients in a big way. You know, one of the things I've talked to a few people about is just how, in the context of Western medicine, there's just a lot of doctors who are not necessarily interested in going outside of their frame of reference.
Right.
And
yeah.
You
I mean,
are
I agree with you. I think
a lot
that it
of
is,
frames of reference.
Yeah, I, you know, they outside of what they're, you know, it's hard, right? I mean, these, you know, our conventional medical docs, you know, this is, so, you know, I've gone through different phases during my career, including, you know, outright anger and disgust with the conventional medical community, and a lot of that that kind of emotion came out of, you know, feeling disempowered as a naturopathic doctor and feeling scorned, and you know what, that stuff doesn't go away. This is in my lifetime. It's going to be an uphill battle in my profession, but my emotional response to it has really changed. And part of that is because I have many more medical doctors that I practice with regularly and who are my friends. And, you know, they are, you know, seeing so many patients to try to get proper compensation for their work because they're completely beholden to the insurance companies. They are seeing people on such an incredibly, such incredibly short increments of time. And they really rely on their very concise and very narrow algorithms to make sure that people aren't dying. You know, I mean, that's what conventional medicine does well.
Right.
Now, of course, I always hope that at some point, you know, they make some room in their own professional lives to go back to why they got into medicine in the first place and make some room to really do the patient care that they want to do, and that they don't get so narrow and so focused that they just disdain all these other incredible healing disciplines that are out there. But, you know, I also try to just have compassion and appreciate where they're coming from. I think patients really thrive when they're listened to, when they feel like somebody really stops and pays attention to them, when they feel like they have a team of people. And I know one of the reasons people tell me all the time that they appreciate me is because they can come to me, they can talk to me about food, they can talk to me about herbs, they can talk to me about medicine. I mean, oftentimes I feel like a translator, you know? I mean, they're trying to put the pieces together.
It's part, you know, what I do, I teach people to walk, and I work with a lot of back pain and a lot of, I don't know if you do this in your practice, but I feel like I want to teach people how their body works. Like, I have a very specific approach to, I feel like if you have an injury, if I teach you how your body works, your injury is much, much more likely to get healed. If you have foot pain and I say, well, you know, your foot's supposed to get placed down in a certain way, and if you know how your body works, you're much more likely to use it better, and that is another piece of the puzzle medicine-wise that I think people aren't empowered to learn. I'll ask, one of the classics for me is degenerative disc disease or stenosis, you know, and
mm-hmm.
someone will say, and they'll be in a pose, and they'll say, well, I have stenosis, and I say, do you know what stenosis is? And they literally look blankly, like, no. And it's like, okay, nothing wrong. You don't have to. You can go to a doctor and be told you have stenosis. But, like, for me personally, I would run home and go to my Google machine and put it in within a second. I want to learn. And I have found that that's my approach, is if I teach people how their body works, and there's so much in our world which compartmentalizes all of this stuff and doesn't encourage people to learn about even themselves and their own problems.
Mm-hmm, for sure. It's true, and that is, I mean, that's kind of how medicine works. It's almost like how medicine gets away with itself, right, is because we're all kind of indoctrinated that we just go and we get told what we have and what to do, and there's no time to ask questions. The doctors are busy, and it's the fact
right.
that we have so largely, you know, taken that one on as a culture that we can kind of continue. And I think it's like the last, you know, 10 years, and it's going to keep getting more and more. The public with their Google machines are saying, no, that doesn't work for me. I need some time. Somebody needs to explain this to me and give me my options. And if you're not going to do it, I'm going to figure out how to go find somebody who will. And, you know, and this is what's changing medicine, you know?
Now, there's definitely an image I talked to somebody else about. Well, I don't know why people don't interview their doctors more, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's just no reason why you have to get somebody's number as a doctor and then go to them. Like, you can really find out a lot about them before you go, and it's not part of our culture in the same way.
It's true. You know, I do probably on average 5 meet and greets a week, meaning people call my office and they schedule 5 minutes to talk with me on the phone.
Great.
Before they come in. And that's because people are paying out of pocket to see me.
Right.
Right? So they're like, all right, well, this woman looks good, but I wanna connect with her a little bit before. So, I mean, I'm doing that with people all the time. And it's good for me. You know, it's good for me too. I don't get to rest on my laurels. I don't get to, you know, I have
right.
to stop and I have to listen and I you know, in a sense, I have to make this person believe that I'm going to be a good person for them. Or again, as I get more more further along in my career, sometimes tell them I'm not the right person. But you know, I get to do that, and they get to choose, and that's the beginning of our partnership. I mean, that sets the stage for a relationship that's very different than you come to me. It's like you decide, would you like to come to me? Do I sound like somebody that you would like to see? You think I can help you? You know, I think I might be able to.
Yeah.
And it's an important beginning to our relationship.
Well, when you say that as you get later in your career, you look at things differently, is that a look at clients differently, is that a confidence issue that, like, as you're working more, you're more confident about what you do have to offer people or not?
Sure. I mean, I feel like I think there's two issues. One is that I understand much better. Well, I know who I can really help. You know, I feel like I know who I can really help. I feel like I know I can identify people that are going to be, that need a different skill set than I have. I feel like that's confidence and knowing myself better. There's also, I think in the beginning, you know, you're so hungry and
yeah, right.
you just take anything because, you know, yeah, you're trying to build your business and because you don't know what you can do and what you can't do. You know, and as I get further along, even in times when I might still be hungry, you know, I feel much more comfortable just saying, like, I know this person isn't for me. I'm not for them. I know we're not a match. Somebody else can help them better. It feels okay to let that go back into the universe, you know, and not be so concerned about, you know, the money portion of it either, which,
right.
of course, is another kind of healer's disease, right? I mean, the whole poverty mentality is a real issue.
That's very interesting stuff for me in terms of I come to my work as a yogi. I'm a yoga teacher, and I started working with people, and it's not that I have two little kids. I need to make a living, and I like money. I like what money affords me, but I also feel it's my job to help people, and I'm interested in a dynamic we see in the healing world that, you know, it's right on my website. If you're in pain and you need my program for free and you have no money, I'm going to give it to you because
mm-hmm.
you have no money and I want to help you. But there's definitely a big issue in this business in terms of that. And a lot of people feel like it's just not a smart thing to do. It's not a good thing to do. People really need to pay you to be getting what they're not going to be able to get what they need if they're not paying for it. How do you feel
yeah.
about that kind of?
Yeah, I've heard that too. I mean, I think that every person is different, you know, and I feel like if someone like yourself can put that out there, that they're able to, you know, help, you know, anyone for free. That, I mean, if I put an ad like that out for myself, I wouldn't have a practice. I mean,
my
practice would be, I would be flooded with people who would come see me for free. I would have to limit it so
totally.
Much so that I could continue to make a living. And I do, you know, I sometimes offer sliding scale, and I kind of, I figure out how to do that for myself. I don't think there's anything wrong with giving services for free or at a discount, as long as you feel like your patient or your client, you know, is really going to show up and do the work, and that you, as the active participant, the healer or whatever you call yourself, can really show up and do the full work too. And I, you know, we talked the first question about be your own healer and take care of yourself. I mean, I think one way that we do that is that we make sure that we are getting compensated properly for our work, and that it's okay to get not only compensated properly, but get compensated well. And that even though we might feel like we're here to serve and we're here to help and heal people, we also deserve to be able to have a comfortable life and be rewarded for our efforts and our education and our study and the good work that we do. And I feel like the more that people are able to come into that, and accept that, the more it flows towards them, and the more that they will find the space to do, you know, the discounted work or the gratis work in a way that doesn't impair that person's ability to take care of themselves. Because, again, if the healer can't take care of themselves, they're not going to be a good healer. So I do think it's a, you know, it's a little bit what we each do with it individually and how we get compensated and how we also offer our services to those who can't afford them. But it's a big deal for non-MD, non-DO providers because there's no system to support us getting compensated well. We kind of have to make it up as we go along.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I can't imagine any 5 or 6-year-old is out there saying, I want to be a naturopath when I get older. What did you want to be when you grow up?
I wanted to be an actress.
Great.
Without a doubt. And I, you know, it's funny because, I do a lot of radio, I do a lot of teaching, I do some TV video stuff, and I, you know, I continue to try to cultivate some of these other things to stay on stage because I do love it so much. But I, you know, I feel like my office is a little bit of a stage in the sense that, not that I'm pretending or play acting, but in that the thing that always fascinated me about theater was the role playing, was you know, getting in involved in the role and connecting with whoever I was acting with, and you know, figuring out how a character is motivated and how a character thinks. And for me, you know, that's part of what I do with my patients is I try to really listen and get at what is going on that's leading to this particular manifestation of symptoms. And, you know, at that's some of my theater training, and that's some of the stuff that I love the most. I feel like that's where some of the biggest breakthroughs happen in the office, too, is when you really kind of hit on something, you know, what's motivating that person, and then you grab it and you say it, and the person can't even believe that you came up with it. So for me, it's like, you know, part of what keeps me passionate, I love the medicine, but I love theater, and so I've had to kind of figure out how to keep that line through what I do, because I really do love that aspect, too.
I just love that connection. I think that's really great. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I feel like what I'm doing is just kind of what you were touching on is how much detective work I have in what I do, and it doesn't matter if it's you know, physical or psychological or emotional, but that I'm trying to figure out just where it all began for them and how much of that kind of detective work is in what you're doing.
Oh, so much, so much. You know, my initial new patient visit is an hour or an hour and 15 minutes, depending. When I first started practicing, my new patient visit was 2 hours. And that's very common with naturopathic doctors and, you know, some folks, constitutional homeopaths, I mean, even longer. And, you know, gradually I've shrank it, not because I couldn't really keep talking all that time and keep listening all that time, but because what I've learned is that you can't do everything in the first visit, and you don't have to do everything in the first visit. You really need to get people started. But the detective work, you know, the going back, you give people, you know, all this time to just sit and kind of go back and tell their own version of the history. It's fascinating that the stuff that comes up and the way things click together, and there's a lot of, you really have to have a big, open, expansive, creative mind to practice integrative medicine, I think, because you know what? There are no algorithms to follow. There is nothing to memorize here. It's, you know, you memorize the physiology. You know what labs to order. I mean, you know that kind of stuff. You know how to figure out that piece. But if you really want to practice integratively, which is, you know, I think naturopathic medicine is, you know, it's certainly an integrative medicine discipline, you have to step back and you have to really be willing to include everything. And there's a lot of that. And that's what makes it such a deep, intense practice. It's it requires a lot from me as a provider on many levels. And And it keeps going, right? And then there's emails and questions, and it's a lot of patient care.
One of the things I teach a lot of anatomy for like yoga teacher trainings, and part of my wrap is I say to them, look, you know, it's not that teaching yoga isn't a great pursuit, because I, you know, 15 years later almost, I still love it. You know, it serves me socially and physically, and it's just so much fun. But in truth, you know, you walk in to teach a yoga class and you know exactly what's going to happen for the next 90 minutes. And in the walking work and the pain work and dirt working with individuals that way, what the best part is that I never know what is about to happen when someone walks in my door. You know, and that to me is just so exciting. And again, there's nothing wrong with being a yoga teacher. It's served me incredibly well. But the excitement of not knowing and the excitement of, like, having to be present to help somebody is really exciting.
Well, it is. I agree. And sometimes you think you know exactly what's going to walk in, you know. And then they start, and I go, whoa, okay, wait. And the thing is, as I move along in my career, my practice gets considerably more focused because I, you know, now I have an expertise. Now I'm specialized in bioidentical hormones, and I have my specialties that I'm known for. And so I see more and more people that come in with specific issues. But I still have this general medicine practice, that peeks its head out. So, you know, I'm kind of, you know, going along in my day, often seeing some similar things, you know, in a row. And then, you know, suddenly, like last week, I had an 8-year-old girl who had been meth exposed in utero, and they'd been managing that. And then she was diagnosed with autism when she was 6. And then at almost 9 years old, she was starting to enter into puberty and having hormonal changes, and they had really had the meth exposure and the autism largely kind of, you know, under control in a way. You know, she was in school and she was doing well, and then the hormonal changes hit, and it was just like all bets were off. They were on a roller coaster. And, you know, that came into my office, and I went, oh, okay, this is going to be interesting. You know, you've got to just really show up and ground down and pay attention. And it's those kind of things that I do look forward to, like you're saying, that are different every time, that kind of get me jazzed up again and get me excited to delve back into areas that maybe I don't get to visit all the time. But the good news is that when you're regularly exercising that detective muscle, you know, that big thinking muscle, that beginner's mind muscle, you know, it's there. It's there for you. You just grab it again.
Well, I also feel like I can never retire, because that's what's going to keep me from my brain turning to mush.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things you'd mentioned just previously about, like, you know, when people come in and you kind of have to help them unravel and when you're doing that detective work. And I feel like a lot of what I'm selling or offering people is kind of convincing them that even though they've had these patterns, that they can change. They don't have to settle for how they feel and the way what they've been stuck in. But I feel sometimes I have a big cheerleading role, you know, believing in them when they don't. How much cheerleading is involved with your practice?
Jonathan, I lost like the last minute of that question. Can you go back?
Yeah, I was just saying basically that I'm very often like a cheerleader for my clients in trying to help them process their ability to change, or a belief in their ability to change. So I was just saying, how much cheerleading is involved with what you do?
A huge amount. You know, it's reassuring. There's a lot of crying in my office, good crying in my office. I do a lot of hand-holding. It's a big part of what I do. I mean, I try to see them where they're at, and I try to love and appreciate them for what they're going through and mirror that back to them and show them how courageous they are and, you know, how much work it takes and that it's possible and that they can do it. And I think I actually do that really well, and I think it's a big part of the effectiveness of this kind of medicine. And you know, and in your own practice, you know, too. I mean, it's like we are often not giving them something to take every day. I mean, we're giving them work that they have to do, behavioral changes that they have to make. This is the hardest, the best, but the hardest stuff there is to do. So, you know, I think a big part of our job is to continue to encourage. And at the same time, you know, you can't do it for them. So I'm also not opposed to, in a very loving way, kind of calling people out for not complying and being like, okay, well, what's up? Because, you know, you're telling me you want to go to San Francisco and you're consistently getting on the train to go to L.A., and I'm not judging you, but you're on the wrong train. So what are we doing? What's happening? And so, you know, that has to go right along with the cheerleading is the being willing to hold them accountable because they need that too. And I know that from my own experience. I mean, I'm the worst patient ever. Maybe not ever, but I'm terrible. And it, you know, and I also need to be held accountable. We all do. We're all human. We all want to feel better without doing the work. We do. It's annoying that we have to work this hard, but we do.
Do you take on the suffering of your patients, like, or what does that look like for you?
Well, I had a very difficult time with that when I was younger. When I told you about the job where I was working with teenage girls in treatment psych, and you know, so they were 13 to 18 years old, and I worked there from the time that I was 22 until I was you know, almost 26. So I wasn't that much older than them, and I took on everything. I had no defenses. And I had to really, really learn how to manage that. And I continued to get a lot of opportunities to work with that, in my practice. But I do think that that initial experience before being a doctor was tremendously useful to me. And then I have had, you know, I do continue to work with that, and I do. I think at this point, I'm pretty good with it. I still get hit on a regular basis. I mean, people come in with some of the most horrific, terrible stories, you know, especially you do a lot of women's health and gynecology, and it's just terrible stories of trauma and abuse and, you know, things that are hard. You know, so I do things like cry a little with them sometimes. You know, sometimes I'm just incredibly moved. But I try really hard not to take it home. And occasionally when I do, fortunately I have a little shining, almost 6-year-old son who can, you know, light me up from a mile away. So I do have him to kind of pull me into the moment, which is very helpful. You know, my exercise practices, my yoga practice, these things are incredibly useful for me to shake that stuff off.
When you spoke about
like
the working with the girls when you were in your 20s, were you aware of that you were taking on their stuff or taking on too much stuff,
you
know, or is it something you only...
You want to be present and connected. You can't completely cut yourself off.
Huh, right.
You know, it's interesting. I had a friend who reads fingerprints, not palms,
uh-huh,
but fingerprints. And I don't go that much in for that kind of stuff, but he offered to do it for me, so I let him. And anyway, it was a very interesting experience. But part of what he talked about was this line that I apparently have on my hand, which is Persephone's line. And of course, in mythology, you know, Persephone was able to journey from the light to the dark, and had to experience both of those things, and was able to make that journey. And one of the things that he said to me was that people with Persephone's line are able to help people, you know, help people with their journeys, you know, from the light to the dark and back to the light. And of course, the consequence of that is that those people usually have to experience the light and the dark to be able to do that. But that it's a real gift to be able to come through that and give that to other people. And I do feel like that's something that I do with people a lot, and help people recognize that experiencing the dark is part of getting to experience the light again, and you know, helping people move through that. And I think that's kind of what we're talking about too.
Absolutely. Well, I do know, like, for a lot of people in the healing professions, you can develop a tendency to not take care of themselves either as well as they're basically because they're so focused on others. Do you find it easier to help others than yourself?
Yeah, infinitely. Yes. It is. And I, as a healer, as a woman, I mean, I think as women, we're kind of wired to do that anyway. And then to be in the health professions, you've got kind of a double whammy. I have become much better over the years at doing things to take care of myself. But it's something that I am still very actively struggling with, working on. Again, as I get older and I get aches and pains and I get things that I ignore and brush to the side and, things that I would never encourage my patients to do. I have been trying to be much more active in trying to address the signs and signals that my own body is sending me and take better care of myself too. So, yeah, it's hard. But I'm really trying to walk the talk here because it's something that I talk to my patients about every single day, and I know that I need to do it too.
And I think it's just, there's an unbelievable power to honesty and not being up on a pedestal to the people you're serving, I think.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's so true, isn't it? I mean, I think that's, people want us to be human. And so, obviously you need to maintain your professional boundaries, but I think that, there's a way to really show your humanity to your patients in a way that really, really serves the relationship, and, it was interesting for me. I mean, I've gotten divorced and, there were some changes in my business and, I'm in Santa Cruz, which is, it's a smaller town and, things don't get kept secret. And, so a lot of my patients kind of knew some of the stuff that was going on in my life and, saw me on my good days and my not so good days. And I just really tried to look at it as an opportunity to just show up and be present and be real. And I don't think it hurt me. I think if anything, it helped me with my practice.
That's great. One of the, in terms of in your clients and watching the growth and changes in your clients, what do you expect of your clients? Or another way is to look at it is how attached are you to their success?
Oh, boy, that's a great question. Those are two different questions, too. I mean, what I expect, my hope is always that, people are coming. I feel like, in general, my patients are motivated because the vast majority of them are paying out of pocket or paying some reimbursement. It's limited. So most of them are really making an investment. They're motivated. They're showing up. And so I expect them to, follow through and get their labs done, for God's sakes, and,
right.
do their best to integrate some of the recommendations I've made. A lot of people are unable to follow through or follow through completely. And so, to a certain extent, I am patient, and I cheerlead, and I hold their hands, and I encourage. I also definitely get attached to outcome. They're kind of two questions, right? So when they're not compliant, when they're not following through, I am encouraging as long as I can be, and then I will come to a point where I'll say, should we get you to somebody else? It doesn't feel like this is working. I mean, you keep coming. I love to see you. I'm making recommendations. You're not doing them. What do we do? Maybe we're not a good fit. I mean, I will do that. From the point of, how attached am I to the outcome, that's a different question to me because a lot of, there are patients where I feel like I'm doing everything I know how to do and they're not getting better. And I do find that terribly disappointing. And I am not perfect. I am certainly not the best naturopathic doctor, the best, I'm not the best anything. I am human and I am doing the best I know how and I am trying to be present. And if I feel like I'm not cutting it, I will be the first one to tell you, let's go talk to somebody else who might be able to help. But I get very disappointed when people don't get better. I have a, that's hard for me. especially if they're doing everything I'm telling them, you know? I mean,
one question is
what happens when they're not doing anything. The other is, what if they're doing everything?
That's a huge difference, right?
It's a huge difference. And you know what? There's stuff that is not medically, explainable. It's an explainable word. I mean, there's stuff that is deeper that I can't always see and I can't always get to. You know, sometimes I just feel like there are other forces at work that make healing very challenging for people. And sometimes I'm just not seeing it. You know, there's lots of different reasons why somebody who is following recommendations doesn't get better, but that I still get attached to.
Yeah, I mean, on a deep level, and it's not, I don't think it's just being totally dark. I'm not sure everyone is here to heal. And a lot of people have a lot of different levels of their, how stuck they are, or, and if you believe in, you know, karma and lifetimes, how many lifetimes of, how much stuff they're working through, and maybe it's not going to happen in this lifetime, even though you're doing everything right and you're really paying attention.
Yeah.
It's just maybe not in it for everybody. Even though you have to work towards it, you don't want to not work towards it. But that's a powerful thing to see.
It is. It's true.
Is, you know, there's a definitely a fine line between enabling and guiding. Like, you know, when we're talking about people not doing the work or having trouble doing the work, do you ever feel like you're doing the work for them, or is it your responsibility to motivate them to get the work done?
I don't do the work for them. I'm not in a position with the way that I see patients to do the work for them, you know? I mean, I make my best recommendations, and I send them off, and I tell them when to come back and check in. So I don't feel like I'm enabling. I don't have the opportunity. Given the opportunity, you know, I might. But I don't really have the opportunity to do that. Now, I think probably earlier in my career, I felt like it was more my job to motivate them. I think at this point, I feel pretty confident that I'm a very good motivator, and that if they're not doing it, it's because something's going on. So I actually feel pretty comfortable saying to people, you know, what's going on? This kind of feels like there's some resistance to what I'm recommending. Like, you know, what's happening? I'm very comfortable turning the conversation in that direction, as opposed to blaming myself for not motivating them well enough.
Yeah, a lot of it, what you've said a number of times, is just about the beautiful nature of doing something for a while and getting more confident. You know, going teaching, like when I'm doing these trainings with yoga, young teachers or wannabe yoga teachers, you know, a lot of it, what I say is, you're in a great place, you want to become a yoga teacher, but it's just nothing gets comfortable for a very long time. I really didn't like teaching yoga for a long time. It took me a long time to not be really insecure and to feel comfortable to where I could really serve people. And I think that you can't, you know, you don't want to say, oh, don't worry, it's going to get better as you get older. But it is so incredibly true.
Well, it's kind of like everything with getting older, isn't it? I mean, in certain ways.
Yeah, exactly, totally.
There's a lot of beauty to experience.
Yeah. What kind of healers have you sought in your life, and what motivates you when you're not up for doing the work?
I regularly see acupuncturists, massage therapists, chiropractors. I have actually one of each. I don't see, at this point, I've kind of got my people. Brooke Thomas, who I think you either are interviewing or already interviewed, was the best Rolfing I ever had in my life, and I wish I still lived close to her, because that was some of the most amazing physical work I've ever done. I have an integrative medical doctor that I work with, who I see when I need anything. That's kind of what I've done. I find that what really motivates me, like the doctor that I see, I when I go to see her and she tells me something to do and holds me accountable to it, I find that, you know, the only child in me who wants to please comes out and I perform. And most of the time she's telling me something that I know perfectly well and have said to other people a million times, but I do have a, it's challenging for me to motivate myself. And, you know, unfortunately, I have also found one of the biggest motivators to be, you know, discomfort and, you know, to finally let something go long enough to where I'm actually uncomfortable, and that will motivate me to actually get my butt in gear and do what I need to do. And when we talk about self-care, that's something that I'm trying to change about myself. I don't want to wait until something is giving me pain or discomfort. I want to be more proactive in doing things that I need to do. And it really just comes back to taking time and making time for myself. So, but when it comes to what do I do when I'm not doing the work, I find that, you know, somebody to hold me accountable a little bit. You know, not everybody needs that from their doctor. People need different things from their practitioners.
Right.
But for me, you know, that works very well. I have some patients like that. I have other patients who just really want me to kind of listen and be a partner with them. You know, I mean, people need different things. But that works. Being held accountable works well for me.
That's great. And I just can't thank you enough for me. This has been really great. I have one more question for you, which is, like, just as a takeaway, what do you think are the most important first steps for someone to take who wants to get on the road to being their own healer?
Well, you know, it's something that I say to my patients, and it's something I say in a lot of the radio interviews that I do and things like that. I encourage everybody to kind of make a list of the activities and the relationships that make them feel nurtured and supported and make them laugh and put them in a place of gratitude where they can recognize the good in their life and feel joyful. And to make that list of those activities and those people, and then to prioritize fitting those things into their life, just like they put food on the table for their family, just like they get the bills paid on time, just like they get to the gym. You know, I think that level of self-care, feeling nurtured, feeling supported, laughing, finding time for gratitude and joy, these are the things that will help us manage our stress, will help us communicate better, and therefore help us in our relationships, and will help us be healthier. So, I mean, for me, I think it can just start with that simple exercise of actually identifying what those things are. And if there's nothing to put down on a piece of paper, I mean, then the first thing to do is to cultivate some activities, or, you know, a person, you know, identify someone, you know, begin to explore what it would be like to find something that makes you feel that way. But, you know, to me, that's the ultimate self-care right there, and that's how you be your own healer, and ultimately that's going to be how you help other people.
That's just awesome. Thank you so much, Amaya. It's really great to chat with you.
Thanks, Jonathan. It's been great.
And for more information on Amaya Gold-Shunney, you can go to her website, drshunney.com, that's drshunney.com, and you can also find her weekly radio show, Green Tea and Honey, which is co-hosted by Chef Jennifer Brewer. You can find the show anytime online at greenteaandhoneyradio.com or via podcast on iTunes. Have a great day.